Hey friends, I hope you're well. Jumping in here to make a little announcement. Actually, it's kind of a big announcement for me, at least. Listen, after spending like a decade, basically, doing this podcast, interviewing authors, musicians, leaders, I have finally written something of my own. I'm really excited about it. This has been a long time coming. It's a long story, and I'll go into that story in detail at some later time, but today I'll just say my book is out. It was co-authored with John Perkins. Many of you probably know who he is, a pastor, civil rights leader. He has an amazing story. If you haven't, go out and grab his books, especially the ones that are more of a memoir. Let Justice Roll Down is probably his first one, and then he's had some after that. They're phenomenal. I had the supreme honor of co-writing this book with him. It's called Go and Do, and you can check it out now. You can get it on Amazon or wherever books are sold, but I will tell you that you can get it for 40% off if you go to my website and go to the tab that says, what does it say? The tab that says discount code. So if you go to shaneblackshear.com/discount-code, it will take you to a place where you can put your email in, sign up, and you will automatically get an email with a coupon code for 40% off. So definitely save that money and go purchase there. If not, like I said, you can, if you want to pay full price, go to Amazon. I won't see any more of that money, so it's fine with me either way. I'd rather you get the discount. So please do that. Like I said, I will be sharing more about this book when the time comes, but for now, it's out, it's there, and I would be honored if you would read it. Okay, here's the show.
Hi, I'm Deb.
This is Frankie V.
I'm Grant.
Hi, this is Phil.
I'm Aaron.
I'm Steven.
Hi, I'm Jim.
Hi, I'm Matt.
We're Tim and Terry.
I'm Susan.
Hi, this is Phil.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
Seminary Dropout is supported by listeners like you and me.
You should support the show like I did.
It's easy.
It's easy.
Just visit supportseminarydropout.com.
Just go to supportseminarydropout.com.
And I'm your host, Shane Blackshear. Interviews with leading Christian authors, leaders, and thinkers. Let's go. My guests, Tim Mackey and John Collins, longtime friends and one-time roommates at Multnomah University, were tossing around ideas on how to help people read through scripture while avoiding the common pitfalls and misunderstandings. How could complex themes of the Bible be presented in a way that was real and unapologetic, but approachable? Combining Tim's deep biblical understanding and John's passion for visual storytelling, they created their first two videos in 2014 and put them online for free. Less than 6 years later, they have over 150 videos and 200 podcasts, which can all be viewed on their website, on the Bible app, YouTube, Vimeo, and more. They have over 100 million views across all the media channels in over 200 countries and have over 2 million subscribers worldwide. Tim and John, welcome to Seminary Dropout.
Yeah, good to be here, Shane.
Did you guys, before you started the Bible Project, did you guys have any like favorite Bible or Christianity related media?
Well, you know, one thing that actually kind of got me into wanting to do documentary type work, which eventually became explainer type work, was Rob Bell's Pneuma videos back in early 2000s. So that was kind of groundbreaking Christian media, really high produced, like sermonettes, I suppose, that were like just high production value, shot on film, but really good communication. Yeah, I really enjoyed those.
It's so funny when I thought of that question, the first thing comes to mind is like, there's not much, right? Like there's not tons. But I thought of the Pneuma videos because I think those were like the first kind of, it felt like the first kind of Christian media that you didn't have to like apologize for. Like at least production quality, and there's stuff for kids, you know, like, VeggieTales, it's respectable, you know, but for adults, you know, and then growing up in the church, you came across like a Sunday school video every once in a while, and it was just real bad in more than one way. But yeah, I thought about those Numa videos, and those also came around in a time where, you know, people were talking about like the emerging church, and there's this kind of idea of like incorporating art in a new way that hadn't been done before. So yeah, I always appreciated those.
Yeah. I don't know how many you did, maybe like a dozen, maybe 20.
Yeah. Something like that.
And then at some point stopped, but I know that they were expensive. I heard at one point that they spent like 100K plus on each. And I just remember thinking like, holy cow, like what, how can you spend that much money on a piece of media?
Yeah. Wow. 100K for each one. I mean, they're only like 15, 20 minutes long.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but that was, you know, me before getting into media. Now I'm like, oh, I totally know how you spend that much money.
You know where that came from.
I could spend that much money. Pretty easy too. Yeah.
Filming someone plant a tree does cost that much money, apparently.
Yeah. I did see that one. I liked that one a lot. Yeah. That was between the two trees. Tim, I don't know if you saw that one, but basically it was the simple point of like the Bible begins with a tree and ends at a tree, and just the tree of life. It's a tree of life theme. And he just, and he tells you that story while planting two trees on a curb. And it's just super simple. So that one probably didn't cost as much. One take, plant a couple trees, tell the story of the Bible through.
That's great.
Through the theme of the tree of life.
Tim, I know that part of your story is that, yeah, you kind of grew up in church, but weren't really into it. And then had a conversion experience at a skate park when you were like 20. Is that right?
Yep. Yeah. That's a good
that old story.
Right.
Yeah. We had
Yeah.
I mean, I think that if my church came to me and were like, hey, we want to do evangelism at a skate park, that's like something I'd roll my eyes at, you know?
Sure. Yeah, sure. But the guy who started that skate church ministry here in Portland is Paul Anderson. And, you know, if you're here right now, he would tell you, you know, he's a unique person. He's just got an obsession for building ramps and skateboarding that never went away, even as an adult. So like, he is just that kind of guy. And, but he also loves Jesus, almost more than any person I've ever met. And he's so passionate. And so he just put together his two passions, and out came this, it's been going, John, over 30 years now. Open multiple nights a week, and they're on actually, they don't have a building right now. They're actually,
they're kind of in a hiatus because,
That's right. The property that they were on got sold.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So anyhow, it's an amazing organization and really, really cool leadership.
I mean, that speaks a lot to just contextualize ministry and evangelism.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. Although, again, if Paul were here, he didn't have some strategy. It was just like, he literally didn't want to do anything else except skate, build ramps, and, you know, talk about Jesus with people. So it was the outcome of all those things in one guy's life. And man, it affected so many people. John and I were deeply impacted, but, hundreds of other people just from the era that we were there, years that we were there, and it existed years before we were there and for many years after. It's really cool.
There's a little cohort of Hebrew scholars that all came from Tim's generation of skate church.
Yeah.
Like all these skateboarders who like started following Jesus and then just got deep into biblical studies and Hebrew and reading and studying Hebrew Bible.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
I mean, there's like, that's a real weird turn because like,
totally.
In the best way. I mean, like, I think of all the kids, like I went to youth camp with, you know, and we got excited about Jesus and like, studying Hebrew wasn't our next step.
Totally. Yeah, there was something about the location being right next to Bible school.
Yeah.
And the relationship there. But then also, I think there's something about the obsession a skateboarder has about like, you know, learning a trick, even though it hurts themselves. I think that actually like applies pretty nicely to learning Hebrew vocab.
I mean, yeah, you're saying that and you're being serious, but kind of joking, but that really makes a lot of sense. I'm not a skateboarder. Being totally serious. I understand that it takes a lot of like repetition and practice over and over. And it seems like there's a huge overlap there with learning any language, but especially a biblical language, especially Hebrew.
Yep. Yeah. There were overlapping things. I think that crew of friends, there were four of us. We all started following Jesus around the same time at that skate park. And then one of those friends signed up for classes at Multnomah Bible College across the street. And then within a year, we were all like going and taking classes together. And then we all started Greek the same year, and then Hebrew after that. So it was like, it was friends, it was community, it was skateboarding, it was ministry, and our lives and whole view of everything was being turned inside out by the scriptures. And we were just having the time of our lives. It was such a great season. So yeah, all four of us went on to get PhDs in Hebrew Bible and are professors somewhere. I guess I'm kind of like a half professor or something. I don't know what I am.
You're like a freelance professor.
I guess so. Yeah. Independent.
Patrick.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, I still, you know, love those guys, and we are working together on projects, and it, but it was a unique season. And I think you're right. All of our temperaments are obsessive in different ways that came out. Yeah.
I mean, part of what I'm thinking when you're telling me that story is like a lot of people, especially those who grow up in church or just have some kind of experience with Jesus, that happens. And then oftentimes when they go to study the nuts and bolts, there's kind of a disenchantment of it, or maybe even like a deconstruction, and then maybe even like a leaving of the faith, because kind of what was presented in their evangelical background was far too simple for what the reality was. And I wonder if you ever like had that crossroads, that or that experience, or you know, just what that was like to you to be exposed to you know, the actual text and the language of the text.
Yeah, I never really had a season like that, aside from I think what started in my mid-20s, which is just every day waking up wondering whether anything I believe about anything is true. But that's more just me wondering about the limitations of the human brain. but it wasn't my deep dive. I had to reconfigure my paradigm, my assumptions about what scripture was at multiple points, but just facing the historical realities of the origins of the Bible and the events talked about within it. But I don't know, nothing that it only ever made me after each season fall more in love with the scriptures and with what just the profound ideas that they're exploring. So what's interesting for John, like for you, you know, well, I get you, I won't tell your story for you, but Bible college it was both helpful, but then also didn't help you really tackle a bunch of your questions as you were going through.
Right. Yeah. We were kind of on two different tracks and Bible college, like, because I grew up in the church, and so I was given a very robust theological grid to like, just, yeah, this is how it works. And at Bible college, I was trying to find that grid within scripture and understand how to like reinforce that grid through scripture. But Tim, you didn't have that. So much, you just kind of were like, oh, I want to follow Jesus and I need to understand this book. So I think I was asking the wrong questions, and I was kind of on, it's interesting, we're in the same book, but like we were just, we were on different missions and we even had some of the same professors, and still I couldn't get out of this groove of just like kind of trying to get the Bible to do a trick that it wasn't doing for me. And so I got discouraged.
The trick was like communicate in a simple, straightforward way.
Just tell me what I need to know and put it in a list and make it simple. I started to kind of give up on the Bible after that, to the degree that you can while still wanting to follow Jesus. So that was a bit of a tightrope walk, I suppose. Yeah.
I mean, I think, John, you're really speaking to what I was talking about, where often if we grew up in an evangelical church, it's kind of, I like the way you put it, there's this grid, right? Like there's this theology we're handed. And I think when we go to the Bible, we're often expecting that the Bible is going to just be a direct arrow to that, theology, to that grid, to undergird it, you know? And sometimes it won't play by the rules, you know. And if we have a strong conviction that that grid is what Christianity is, then that's really scary, you know, when the Bible won't uphold that grid.
And there were certain parts of that I was willing to hold loosely. I'm fine with ambiguity, and I'm okay with relearning things and rethinking things. So I wasn't trying to hold on to anything too dearly, but I didn't have an alternative really to try to understand the Bible through, except for that grid. And so it became an uninteresting challenge to try to understand the Bible.
Tim, I know for you, you know, it's one thing to go to a Bible college where, you know, ostensibly professors at least have some sort of pastoral heart where they care about your faith. It's another to go to, like, was it University of Wisconsin? Is that where you went? Yeah. Got your doctorate in biblical language, where I would assume the professors probably aren't so much concerned about the pastoral part of that.
Yeah. No, it was not a religious studies department. It was it was a cross between history and language. So, and almost all the students, Jewish and Christian, who were there had a deeper, you know, religious or faith kind of motivation under there, but the whole spectrum, I mean, just all across the different traditions. So, and we didn't talk about that stuff. We just read Isaiah in Hebrew for a year. It was so amazing. And I think it's just that it was a space to just allow these texts to be what they are. And then it was on my bus rides home after class each day or whatever over the years to just let scripture reconfigure how I approached it. And some seasons of that were more, required more creativity, a little more disorientation than others, but it was always just discovery. I never had this sense of like my world's falling apart, but I think it's just that because I didn't have that sense of a grid of what the Bible ought to be or be saying. It was just all discovery and excitement.
I mean, I think that leads into my next question, which is, let me tell this story real quick. During the pandemic, like a lot of people, I got on TikTok, which is just an absolute, just a terrible idea, but here we are. And there's a Bible scholar that keeps coming up in my feed. He's not a believer, but he answers questions and he says different things, responds to comments.
Yeah.
And what's been so interesting is that he, as you would imagine, and I guess he should, he sees everything through a historical critical lens. So there's no, you know, for him, there's no redemptive hermeneutic. Mm-hmm. You know, there's certainly no like lens of the cross for which to read all of scripture through, you know, especially the Old Testament. And I just wonder, because I know something that you guys say a lot is that the Bible is a unified story, you know? And so, you know, I just wonder what, with your background, especially on the doctoral level, how those two kind of things play into each other, like how those relate to each other, having the education of the historical critical background, but also not stopping there and knowing that, yes, you know, these passages say, for instance, in the Old Testament, say something, and often those rub up against our modern sensibilities. But those often aren't ultimate ethics. Those are actually going somewhere. There's movement in the text.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great question. I mean, yeah, in terms of our approach and what we're trying to do, at Bible Project, it's explicitly confessional or messianic. Are you Christian? I guess the little tweak is one of the puzzles that I did start thinking about, and what was it was motivating to me early on, was about how Jesus and the apostles appealed to the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew scriptures, but would quote from them, appeal to them, do things with them that I did not understand. The way they would quote them, the way prophecy and fulfillment worked. And sometimes it seemed to work, and but other times you go back and read those passages in context and you're like, what? Where did they pull that out of it? And so that was an early motivator for me, because I was like, either they are out of sync with what these texts actually meant and just made them do whatever they want. And so the Messiah could have been some other guy, Ephraim, you know, Ben Yirmiyahu, and they could have done the same thing, you know, and made up stories about it all. And so that stuck with me, like, what is it uniquely about how they're working with the scriptures that actually, maybe, is it possible that they understand these texts more than I do, more than we do? And so, man, modern biblical studies, the way the state of play now is the result of a long, complicated history that is called the history of modern Western civilization. But what historical critical biblical studies, for the most part, the project originated, you know, in the kind of the 1700s as a rival to confessional, more faith-oriented interpretations, both Jewish and Christian. And that, it kind of remains the same today in different ways, even though there's become confessional versions of these methods. I don't know. I've been through a revolution in many ways in the last few years about my understanding of how the Hebrew Bible works, where I, you know, if I could sit my past self down, I would have all sorts of disagreements with my past self. So my analogy would be this, and I'll try not to go on because it's a complicated topic, but the analogy would be modern biblical studies is like going to a modern museum exhibit on ancient Egypt. And instead of actually experiencing the exhibit and like putting on the audio and walking through it, you become an expert at each artifact, but also its prehistory before and how it got into the museum presentation. And essentially what modern biblical study is, a whole wing of it, is doing is trying to reconstruct what all of these things were in their previous life before they ended up in the museum presentation. And what those things meant in some other context is really interesting, actually. It's fascinating, and that's cool stuff. But this is a different question than sitting down and saying, but someone architected this museum experience on purpose this way to communicate something to me. What is that? And that's the thing that I'm really interested in now, is that second question. And I do think that the Hebrew Bible in its final shape really is pointing to some need for an anointed representative to save Israel and therefore save the world. I think that's its historically intended meaning. But so, and I get that happens to overlap with what Jesus and the apostles also thought it was about. But it's also what all kinds of other Second Temple Jews thought that these texts were about. So for me, it's kind of all, it's kind of come back together again. And I don't see the tension. I don't experience the tension anymore, but that's because I'm asking different questions than I was trained to ask in graduate school, which was more about how to take the Hebrew Bible apart and then understand it in the state it was before it was put together. I don't know if that makes any sense. I might've rambled for a really long time just then.
No, I love that metaphor or that illustration. Hmm. Because I think that you talk about the tension. I think a lot of the tension people feel is that if this wasn't history and history as defined by like modern journalistic standards, mm-hmm. then it can't be authoritative. And that's not even, we wouldn't even limit that to the Old Testament, right? And I think, you know, I was a relatively older when I realized that like the writers of the gospel weren't like writing in their journals every night, and that's what not what the gospels are, you know. And so like John, you know, or the writer of the Gospel of John, you know, he's got like a lot of decades to reflect on and decide how I want to boil down and crystallize the teachings of Jesus to fit in this letter, which kind of goes back to what you were saying of like, you know, we want to talk about, well, where did it come from before it got in this museum? But part of the beauty is saying, no, someone wanted to communicate something really specific to me about what's here, you know? So I think that that's a perfect metaphor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the way that scripture was designed to function was that as a museum exhibit experience to have an effect on communities of people and shape how they live in the world. And it's an interesting historical question to get behind the exhibit or behind these texts. And it's important and it's cool. It's a cool project, but it's a different question than asking, how are these scripture telling a unified story that's going somewhere? And because that's historically how Jews and Christians have read these texts and experienced them. So I think that, and that's also in a project that you can study historically with language and culture tools. And that's what we're trying to do with the Bible Project is help people level up on things that they intuit the Bible should be able to do. But like John was saying, often our church traditions don't equip us to really encounter the Bible the way it's designed to be and how to understand it on its own terms.
I mean, you know, the name of this podcast is Seminary Dropout. And the idea was, you know, I noticed when I went to seminary, there just seemed to be this large gap between seminary and what the average person in the pews knew and understood. And also what I felt like the average pastor was teaching. Oftentimes the pastor actually just didn't know any better, but sometimes it was almost like they were protecting them from the truth. But I feel like what was actually happening was they were protecting them from the beauty and the complexity of it all and a deeper faith and understanding. John, I want to talk to you. I know that you approached Tim about starting the Bible Project. Did you already have like an animation studio up and running before that point?
I did. Yeah. I'd built one, to do this kind of work mainly for tech companies. We were doing a ton of work and it grew pretty rapidly. And so I had made hundreds of these videos and just understood the production process pretty intimately. So, we used like some of the machinery of that animation studio. Although we kind of took bits of it and then just kind of worked with certain people and to kind of find our way into what we wanted to do. And then we built our own animation studio from scratch. And with the people we wanted to build it with and kind of the culture we wanted to build, and which was really wonderful because I had so many kind of redos that I wanted to do in terms of how to build a good culture and how to treat artists and how to create an organization.
The kind of like house style of the Bible Project, like the animation and what things look like, did that come from you?
Some of the creative direction came from me, but we were working with this guy, Robert Perez, who we still work with. He's our creative director. And he kind of comped out some style directions for our first videos. I don't know what you're referring to with the house style, but one of the very first styles was this what we call the doodle style. And I just remember talking to Robert going, yeah, just, you know, what a really great artist would just doodle if he just was like having fun on a sketch pad, just doodling really fast. And that was the creative direction. And he kind of went from there.
I do. I mean, now that you mentioned that, I remember some of the earlier videos that had that, like it's actually like being animated in real time look to it. But you know, like, I feel like somebody pulls up your YouTube channel right now and sees the latest videos. Like there's, you know, there's a, like a color palette and they're the people kind of look a certain way, and that sort of thing. So I'm not an artist. So, you know, if house style might not be the term.
We try to intentionally really mix up the style. And so you'll find a wide variety of illustration styles. And partly because we want, whenever we approach a new topic or theme, we want the ideas to inform the style. And, but then also we just don't want to get bored. We don't want our artists to get bored, and we don't want our viewers to get bored and just doing the same exact style over and over and over. Would feel a little tedious.
We did one series that was an overview of all the books in the Protestant Bible, and every one of those has the same style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we've done a couple where it's like six videos in one style as like a little series on something.
Yeah.
But for the most part, some series, you know, have the same style over many videos, but overall the goal is variety. Yeah.
Well, I get the feeling that you intentionally keep in mind an audience that's not exclusively American when you're making these.
More and more we've realized we're a global brand, and the reach is worldwide. We get more views on our English YouTube channel outside of the United States than within the United States now, which is crazy. And then we have our videos translated into over 40 languages, and that's crazy. So yeah, we need to think about that. But maybe one thing that you're picking up on, and this has been a kind of a beautiful obsession of Tim's, is just to make sure that our characters are not modern white people, like that they actually are Middle Eastern characters when we're depicting them kind of realistically. And then also when we're using character designs that are more kind of generalized ideas of just humanity in general, you know, using colors and shapes that aren't your, you know, traditional bathroom sign kind of people. I'm really proud of that.
Maybe another piece, Shane, is a big value for me that I do still carry from my graduate training is the historian's impulse to like let Let the scriptures and the world and culture that they come from, let them be what they are. And try as much as we can to be self-critical and not impose our assumptions about the world on them. And so since all these texts and the people in them come from ancient Israel, there's a sense, what's odd is that there's nothing universal about ancient Israel. It's like a very small people group from a limited window in human history. But because that's the sense, that's what the biblical story comes out of that. And so because of that, and because Christianity has a worldwide, diverse, global makeup, that story has become universal. And so if you talk the language of that story in its own terms, you can translate it into Japanese, you can translate it into Romanian and Brazilian Portuguese, and people find it as a unifying center, which I think is so amazing. So maybe that's it too, is we're trying to import as little of American. And here's where we both grew up on the West Coast of the Northwest, you know, like, so I'm sure there's all kinds of stuff going on in the language we choose that we don't even know that's stamped by our cultural background, but I think we try. And maybe that's why it's been able to cross cultures, is because it's more, I don't know, trying to foreground the Bible, and the Bible is cross-cultural. Sure. So.
Yeah. And I mean, I even think of, you know, some of the illustrations and metaphors that are used. It seems like those are, they're pictures that are accessible or would be accessible for anybody around the world, you know?
Mm-hmm. I know one cool example, and just like in our How to Read Biblical Poetry, we used as our base English example, roses are red, violets are blue, in the actual video. And of course it only rhymes in English, and it's a very, you know, the rhyme and all of that thing. And so I remember in Japanese, our Japanese team put in the most famous, the ultimate famous Japanese haiku about the frog in the water, the frog jumps in the water, silence.
I don't know that one. Okay.
But so that was a good example where, you know, the localization and translation teams have all the freedom to contextualize and readapt the script, even if they need to. And so stuff like that is fun to watch as it develops and goes into other cultures.
John, did you know from the beginning that you wanted to kind of integrate your faith in your animation and the business around that?
I knew there was a project to be done that was an integration of those things. And the reason I got really interested in explanation or in communication and even more generally is because of my faith and knowing that the way that God speaks to us is through communication. The way that we understand the world and who we are and what the good life is, all this stuff, like we learn that through good communication, and then our imaginations can be changed. And then really from an evangelical background, like what we believe is who we become, you know? And so communication can shape what we believe. And so that was all part of my heritage. And I started getting really mesmerized by these certain communicators who could like teach in a way where not only was I learning new information, but I was like understanding something at like a new level. Like they were giving me a new grid or a new infrastructure by which to understand something, you know, a paradigm is shifting. And I just became really obsessed with that. That was one reason why I like those Numa videos. To go back to that, is I think Bell was doing that in his 15-minute shorts. He was kind of giving you kind of a fresh perspective and helping you understand that really quickly and efficiently. So I got into documentary filmmaking, or at least that's what I wanted to do, thinking that was a great medium. And the idea there was I wanted to do it for my faith and for the Bible, but I just didn't know. I didn't know how. I didn't have the answers. And I just knew I was making stuff up. And so I was like, man, I need to figure out how to explore through other people being the expert. And that's what documentarians do, or journalists do. And so that was the skill I wanted to develop. And I thought that could apply to all sorts of realms. But yeah, I wanted that to circle back and apply to the Bible, to my faith. And Tim, as a friend, was a guy who it was always helpful to talk with him to understand the Bible more. And he would give me these great ways to ask the right questions, to get to the right paradigm. And so I thought, let's work on a project together to do that. And was really enamored by YouTube. This was like 2011, 2012, when we first started talking about Tim, maybe. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. YouTube was probably 6 or 7 years old at that point, but still felt pretty early. Just the ability to carve out a space on the internet, a free broadcast medium. Let's do it. Let's go for it.
Well, part of your kind of model is that you're funded by donations. You're probably not spending $100,000 on each video, but it's still, it can't be super cheap. And, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I've heard that it's worked out pretty well with that model for you. Yep. Mm-hmm. And I wonder was that something that you were surprised about? I mean, people can talk about and be romantic about, you know, oh, it's ministry, it shouldn't be about the money. And like, that's true and fine. But people probably aren't going to like let their family starve because they're working on ministry all day long either. No, right? It's got to be sustainable too.
Well, we were able to work on it without needing to make money on it, which was a real gift. Tim's church that he was working for at the time was donating his time to the project. I was able to step away from a business that was still paying my bills and work on it. So that was amazing. We just needed money to pay the artists. And I kind of anticipated it would just be a side gig perpetually. We just would have enough money to pay artists. We would carve out enough time to write scripts and direct. But I also really studied what other YouTube channels were doing with raising money. Patreon didn't exist yet at this point, which I know you're on. And so you know how that works. But that's a great way for creators like yourself to get people to back an ongoing project. What did exist at that point was Kickstarter, which is good for like, I'm going to make this one video.
Right.
I'm writing this one book. I'm just doing this one project, then it's done. However, there was one group, and it was a couple of YouTubers who did an early version of what Patreon became. Patreon actually ended up buying what they were doing. And they had a handful of YouTube channels that were raising money on a monthly basis from their subscribers to fund the creation of new videos. And I just looked at all the math, like how many subscribers did they have? How many views did they have? How much money were they bringing in every month? And then I just had the spreadsheet and I just was like, okay, if we can get this many views, we could probably make this many dollars, and then we can make this many videos. And it all added up. What was surprising was I way over anticipated how many views we would get. I was used to making videos that would like easily get a million views within like a couple of days. Just, you know, would catch the right internet wave and then boom, million views. And I thought for sure one of our videos is going to pop like that. But in the early days of Bible Project, no video ever did. We have lots of videos now that have over a million views, but like it's been this very accumulative climb. So underestimated how many dollars we would get per view. These other YouTube channels were like science channels and stuff, and people were generous to them, but no way as generous as people have been to us, like tenfold what I was projecting. So, and then over time, just the compounding factor of people staying on month after month and becoming monthly subscribers, it just grew at a pace that made it possible for us to actually like quit our jobs and do it full time and build a whole animation studio and not rely on contractors. And that was not anticipated at all. That was a surprise.
I think we had the core of the animation design team that we have now before either of us even moved over to doing it full time.
Yeah.
So the core team, I think we had 5 or 6 people just cranking full time, and you and I were, you know, at halftime or 3/4 time, something like that. And so it was really slow, even though looking back, it feels fast, but it was in those first few years, it was kind of every quarter or 6 months there, we could see something move and get another artist or start giving a little bit more time. So yeah, it was really, really amazing. And then the stories of generosity are always attached to people who have stories that they want to tell us about what they're learning,
that's awesome.
How it's affecting them, what's going on with their church community. And so our support community, we've really invested in connecting with them, giving them spaces to share stories, to hear. And it's just really amazing. It's really, really cool. To see people undergoing their own encounters with what the scriptures are and what they're telling and the person they point to, it's mind blowing. It's so fun to get to hear all the stories. So that's been a really rich part of it. And then another part is it's like a really accurate feedback loop for any piece of content that we make. And so we kind of early on, they had this idea of if no one finds them valuable, we won't raise enough money and we'll get a very clear indicator of if this is going to help anybody or not. And so that has also been the case where each quarter and year, the support community kind of sets the pace for what we can do the following year with the resources that they're giving. And so that's allowed us mostly to scale up, but just at the pace of the support community. And so that's been for me, I'm not business model minded, period. All of this was managed by John in the early days. And I would just ask him all my questions. But it's been really amazing to watch this whole community around the world come into being through the project.
You know, I've been able to, through this podcast, interview a number of musicians. And one of the things that I've learned is that the skill of making good art and the skill of learning to make money making that art are two different things. And sometimes it's kind of sad because sometimes people, they have the skill to make the art, but the other part they don't have. And at the same time, I feel like there's a real hunger for like good Christian art these days as well. I have some friends that I've gotten to know because of the podcast, Ryan and Amy Green, and they made this video game. They're believers and their young son died of cancer, and they made this video game about the experience of their son dying of cancer. And they're kind of wrestling with God and where God was in that. And this video game is like won all of these awards. They've been on like all the like NPR-ish type podcasts telling their story and stuff. And it's thrived because it's good art, you know?
Yeah, there's a niche that kind of carved out in the early 2000s for the artist entrepreneur. And if you could figure that out, like the internet was your oyster. And some people are really good at that. But some people aren't designed that way because it's kind of two very different skills. And artists are used to like going to the business people and saying, hey, can you build the like the organization around my art. And sometimes that works really well, and sometimes that doesn't. And the internet shook things up, and so artist entrepreneurs could come and figure something out. And now there's all these cool tools that you don't have to be so entrepreneurial. You can kind of just use these tools and really lean into your art. And really, I'm super excited. I don't know how much you or your audience thinks about what they're calling Web3 now, which is just kind of like, you know, what blockchain is doing and cryptocurrencies and the potential of that also for artists and for business people who are more of the kind of entrepreneurial side, being able to, you know, own your art. And for supporters, you know, like now a musician can like fund the creation of their first album through like NFTs or through like their own kind of cryptocurrency, that if you're an early backer of a musician, that that musician becomes really popular. Like you essentially, you're what you have now a stake in this. And what they're calling Web3, which is really just this blockchain, is making that all possible. And it's really exciting. And that's a total random tangent.
No, that's really interesting. I feel like nothing makes me feel like a more of an old man than talking about like NFTs and blockchains. I'm like, oh, that this is where I'm like, you know, I was born in 82, so I'm like an elder millennial, and I'm like, oh, this is the line where like
I love it.
I no longer automatically understand what's happening in the internet.
One way to look at that from another angle, though, and that's been all part of our experience, was the goal wasn't to make money because we already had good jobs, but the goal was just to make the content. And so we did invest and raise enough resources to start making the first videos. And then it was kind of an inverted scheme where it was about, we could give something away. And then if you like this thing that we gave away, we could give away another one, help us do that. And so that has been the way the process worked. And that was really an incarnation of a deep value that John learned in his own life and from his first couple of businesses. The leading with generosity just changes the economy of relationships in a really powerful way. And it's been transformative for me to be a part of a project where we get to give everything away because it's already been paid for. So we don't, I think we have one thing we sell, which is a coffee table book. And I think we've only ever made even on that coffee table book. But it's just kind of like a perk, and it's a fun thing to do. But for me, that's been a really cool part of the journey, is to be a part of an organization that gets to give away everything that it makes.
I wonder how you think about making something like talking about the Bible in a way that it's so hard to almost say anything about the Bible on the internet. And I'm just talking about like, I'm not talking about like hot topic things, but in an ecumenical way, and where it's not just like your take on something. I got to have this conversation one time with this guy who runs this website that's basically like people just send in questions about the Bible and someone answers them. And I thought, man, like how, when often scholarship is not decided on something, like how you answer something definitively. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's so many takes, you know, like somebody's like, well, what's communion? You're like, well, I mean, you know, it depends like what stream are you coming from, you know?
Yeah.
Like the most honest answer is like, well, here are the, you know, whatever three main answers that Christianity has given us in history or whatever, you know? But I'm really curious how you kind of navigate that when you're making videos about the Bible.
Well, this is going to be an oversimplified way to think about that question, but one of the reasons why there's so many different traditions in Judaism and Christianity is because to really run, to organize and run and create clarity of an actual community of faith that's somehow living in continuity with these ancient texts, you have to fill in so many gaps, because these texts aren't a handbook for how to be a Christian and run a church. And that's where all the division comes, is how do you make these ancient texts offer clarity about this communion, or how to structure a leadership team, or how to make the Bible address this or that topic. And so in other words, the problem isn't with the Bible. The challenge is that we're making the Bible speak to things and give clarity to things that, oh man, there's not a lot of clarity about if you actually go read it, because it can be read 10 different ways. So that's one way to approach the Bible. The other way to approach it is to say, what is it that the biblical authors care about and the stuff that they focus on and are developing that runs through the whole thing? And these are the things that actually all of the traditions have in common. Because it's like the seedbed out of which everything grows that later divides and splits. But what's all the stuff before all the splitting of the traditions that everybody agrees on, but no one ever talks about it because it's not the controversial stuff, or it's not the boundary line issues of our tribe or denomination. So this is what's called biblical theology. And you're just trying to understand the text on their own terms. And of course there's puzzles and there's difficult passages, but communion, you can approach communion starting with our questions and the diversity of traditions. What you can flip it is just say, where does the theme of food provided by God that brings connection to God, where does that theme begin in the biblical story? Oh, page one. And then just start following it through. And it turns out the biblical authors are developing this theme about how feasting, eating the bounty of God's good creation, is a way to commune with God and others. And then there's this elaborate theme you can follow through the Torah, the prophets, and the writings, and the gospels. And then you make a video about that, and everybody's like, yeah, that's awesome. That's in the Bible, and nobody disagrees. And that's the stuff we're trying to do.
I mean, I think that's so helpful, because I think as Christians always, and I feel like especially right now, there's a moment where people are trying to figure out how do I read the Bible and what place does it have in my life? Can it have any authority in my life, or can God have any authority in my life through the Bible? And I feel like what makes that so hard for some people is because we're not reading the Bible on its own terms. So like I mentioned to you guys before we started that I interviewed Beth Allison Barr, who wrote The Making of Biblical Womanhood. And, you know, if you believe that the text is prescribing something really misogynistic, then that really influences how you answer that other question, right? Like, do I want to follow this book, you know? And so before you answer that question, you've got to know like what the text is actually saying. You've got to be able to read it on its own terms as much as you can.
And on some themes, the biblical authors give more airtime, more focus, more clarity, because they're the main themes that they're developing. Other ones they gave less airtime to. And or they just, you know, the Apostle Paul wasn't writing a handbook out of all of his letters, you know, like, you know, we have these 13 letters written at different times to different audiences. And like, we are the ones trying to synthesize out of that, you know, a Pauline handbook on theology and church practice. And it's challenging because we're trying to make his letters do things he didn't design for them to do. We can gain wisdom from that, his writings, but it's just that very thing. And so that's one piece. And then the other piece, right, is when there's when the culture gap between the biblical authors and a reader's culture and sensibilities, when that becomes really stark or in tension with each other, what do you do with that tension? And because it's not just us, like we can go talk to our Brazilian brothers and sisters or our brothers and sisters in Sudan. And when they read the Bible, they have all these different tensions than like Americans do. And so like whose tensions count more? Or maybe it's just, it's built into it that to be a Christian is to invite to see the biblical literature as part of our family story that gives wisdom for how we follow the Messiah and the leading of the Spirit today. But it's going to look different and be expressed differently because the image of God is really diverse. I think it's just how it's going to be. But already I'm operating from a certain paradigm, and there would be Christians who come to the table who have different assumptions about what the Bible ought to be and do. And so I respect that too. But we're operating out of a set of convictions as we move forward with the content that we make.
Yeah. And actually, that's a good kind of segue to one thing that we could plug is that we're going through what we're calling our paradigm series, which on our own podcast, we're talking through what is the Bible actually? What type of literature is it? And so we're speaking around this a little bit. And we just released on Monday an episode about the Bible as wisdom literature. And that's so yesterday. I don't know when this will go live, but that's the idea that Tim's talking about, which is the Bible is meant to give us wisdom. And but then also the Bible is ancient literature and it's rooted in its own context. And so when you're trying to address facts on the ground in your own community, like gender norms or how to deal with
economics. Politics, for example.
You're coming from a different cultural set of facts on the ground than the Bible does. And so being able to appreciate that and tease that out, takes some effort
And a community.
And a community of people to do with.
That's a good word, John. You know, when I watch the videos, or when I hear you both speak about the Bible, I think one thing that comes out is like an actual love for the text. And I think that even people who say they like the Bible or they appreciate the Bible and what it does, like so very few of us love reading the Bible, like, you know, in the same way that we, I don't know, watch or like excited about, you know, the next episode of Breaking Bad or whatever, you know. And I just wonder what you would say to people who kind of struggle with that.
Yeah. Well, I think Tim brings that energy. And because I'll get glimpses of that. And I'll get really excited. And then if I read on my own, oftentimes I'll be like, I don't know. I'm still stuck.
This happened recently.
Yeah.
Judah and Tamar story.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, spent so much time in Genesis over the years. We've never talked about that story. And you were just jamming on Genesis. And then you're like, you hit that story and you're just like, Tim, what the gosh?
I know. I had so much compassion for the person who's trying to read through the Bible in a year, right? And they they get through the, you know, the creation stories and the talking snake. And then you've got these, you know, you got the flood, which is like, you know, this pretty crazy thing with then these Nephilim, these half gods, and you're like, oh, how do I get? And then you're like, you get through that, and then you get to like a guy you think is normal, Abraham, and you try to hang there, but some of those stories you're like, man, Abraham doesn't seem like as good of a guy as he should be. And I thought this was something else. And then you get to these stories of like Judah and Tamar, and you're like, this is rough. Like, how am I gonna? And you haven't even gotten yet to the like priestly tech manual stuff like everyone thinks they're gonna give up on. So it could be really hard to do. Tim often says the cookies are not on the bottom shelf. It takes a community. It takes reading and rereading and allowing it to confuse you, allowing it to make you uncomfortable and to even frustrate you, is I think all part of the game. And that's difficult. I remember Tim having a conversation with you about Psalm 119. I think that's the Psalm, right? That's the big like alphabet.
The big one. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And the whole thing is about just how awesome the Bible is. Oh, how I love the Bible. Oh, I love it so much. And I can't believe how much I'm in love with the Bible. And just over and over and over. And I like read that sometimes. And I'm like, you're joking. Like, really? Like, you love the Bible that much? It's hard to read. And it's sometimes really boring and confusing. And but there is something there that once you start seeing how it works, and you start understanding how it works as meditation literature and wisdom literature, and the way that the grain of this literature works, there is something really beautiful there. And you start to get why the psalmist would be so enamored with the Torah. And so I'm taking baby steps.
Yeah, 7 years. 7 years in, you're taking 7-year-old steps, man. That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, John, you mentioned the, you know, reading the Bible in a year plans. Do either of you do either of you have recommended ways for which someone should or could read their Bible?
Well, thank you for asking that question. Because we do, in fact. We are. What are you releasing this?
So, not this Friday, but next.
Okay. Well, your podcast audience is going to be the one, the first to know that in 2022 we have a new, brand new reading journey that we're going to do. We're going to read through the Bible slowly. We're only going to probably read through the Torah in 2022. We're going to read in larger sections of the Bible that we're calling movements. So each scroll of the Bible, each book of the Bible has 3 or 4 movements. And in each movement, we're going to trace one biblical theme and kind of learn to see how that theme is developed and how you can find it and trace it and see it develop within that movement of scripture. What we like about it is, one, it's a way to kind of develop two skills. One skill is seeing the structure of the Bible in a new way, which is movements, not chapters. That's a whole rabbit hole, but chapters are not native to the Bible. But there is a native literary structure to these books. But the second skill is actually learning to trace what Tim was talking about before. Biblical theology, biblical themes, and being able to find them in the text and let them develop at their own pace and on their own terms. And then another cool thing about it is that with a reading plan, you get behind, you get discouraged. With this, it's like, yeah, jump in and do one. They're modular. You don't have to go in order. You can just do them as you want. There's no getting behind. There's no catching up. And so we'll be doing those basically a movement every 2 or 3 weeks next year. And
where, John, where do you find and encounter?
Tim's doing reading, my job reading now. Experience.
I think in your mind, you said You thought you said where this is going to happen.
No, I didn't. I didn't. Well, that's the other thing we haven't told any of our audience, really, I don't think. And we won't have by next Friday is we actually have our own app that we're releasing in January. And in that app, you'll be doing these reading journeys. So we have a lot more control over that whole experience of finding the themes and all that through these reading journeys. So that app will be available in January. We'll be announcing it at the end of the year. And we're stoked on it. Power Project app.
You heard it here, folks. No, but seriously, that's super exciting. That's really cool. So it's going to be all through the app. That's where people can interact with it.
Yeah. Yep.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And when did you give a date when it's going to be available in the new year?
Yeah. January 1. We'll have, I think, Black Friday, Giving Tuesday is what they call it in the biz. It's the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. We are going to have an announcement that we're going to have an announcement. And on that announcement, you can give us your email and we'll tell you like where you can like find the app when it's available, or just, you know, search the app store next year, you'll find it. And then we'll announce on December 10th, we'll have a big kind of announcement on our website about everything.
That is super exciting. Sincerely, I'm looking forward to that, participating in that. I love it. Cool. Well, Tim and John, this has been so much fun talking with you. Like I said, I wanted to talk with you for a long time. So it's a real treat. And thanks for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, totally. Good to talk with you, Shane.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Remember, you can find all the show notes for this show and all shows at shaneblackshear.com. Oh, and hey, have you ever thought about starting your very own podcast? I bet you have. And I think you should do it. In fact, I've created a course just for you to teach you everything that I've learned over the last couple of years producing Seminary Dropout. So if you're interested in podcasting and want to learn how, go check out my course. You can go there by typing in podcastingforeveryone.org. And you can get a special discount by typing in the discount code Seminary Dropout, all one word. That'll give you 25% off. So go check it out. If you have any questions, let me know. Okay. Thanks to those that left ratings and reviews on iTunes this week. Remember, that keeps the show front and center. Also, remember, you can find me on Twitter at @beardonabike. That's @beardonabike. Also, I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/ShaneBlackshear123. And remember that Seminary Dropout is listener supported. You can visit supportseminarydropout.com and press Become a Patron. Remember, this music you're listening to right now is by D.L. Rossi. You can find him online on iTunes and at dlrossi.com. All right, thanks again for joining me for another episode of Seminary Dropout. Stay tuned for next week's episode. Love you. Take care. Yeah, that's my best.